Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, The Existence of God, Part 19. And for more information and resources, go to reasonablefaith.org.
We've looked at three arguments for God's existence, and today we want to come to the moral argument. The American Humanist Association is sponsoring a bus banner campaign in certain U.S. cities, which carries the message on the side, "No God, no problem." And then the subcaption says, "Be good for goodness sake." And I thought that was a very, very clever ad, especially that slogan, "Be good for goodness sake." That should be familiar to you, right? That comes from the children's popular Christmas song about Santa Claus is coming to town. But as the humanists use it, it involves a very clever pun. It's a double entendre. It's different from the way it is in the children's song. Remember in the children's song, Santa Claus is portrayed as this sort of omniscient God surrogate who is keeping a list and checking it twice. He's going to find out if you are naughty or nice. And so the advice of the Christmas song is you better not pout, you better not cry, you better not shout. I'm telling you why Santa Claus is coming to town. Like the second coming of Christ, Santa Claus is coming, and he's been making this list, and he's going to find out whether or not you've been good. In fact, it says this all-seeing surrogate deity called Santa Claus, he knows when you've been sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good. So the advice is, be good, for goodness sake. Now here, the advice to be good, for goodness sake, is a sort of expletive. It's like saying, for goodness sake, be good. Why? Because Santa Claus, he's coming. So it would be as if you would say, be good for heaven's sake. It's just a sort of expletive. But when the humanists say this, it's different. When the humanists say this, there's no comma, be good, comma, for goodness sake. The humanists say, be good for goodness sake. That's why you be good, because goodness is an end in itself. You be good for goodness sake. And I think what the humanists rightly see is that this perverted Santa Claus theology gets it completely wrong when it says the reason you be good is because of the rewards or the desserts that might come from being good or being bad. That you're looking out for self-interest, and that's why you be good. And what the humanists rightly see, I think, is that that is a very perverse kind of theology. You should be good for goodness sake. Goodness is an end in itself. You're to do good because it is good. The problem I have with the humanist slogan is not with that subcaption, it's with the main one. No God, no problem. The problem is, if there isn't any God, why think that there is any goodness for which sake we can be good? If there's no God, then why think that good and evil objectively exist? So that the question that's raised, I think, by the issue of atheism is whether we really can be good without God. Now, at one level, the answer to that question is obvious. We all know people who are not believers in God, who live good and decent lives. Many of us come from families like that, good, decent, hardworking folks who may just not believe in God, but it would be arrogant of us to say that they don't live good lives, good and decent lives. So at one level, of course you can be good without believing in God. But that's not the question that's raised by the American Humanist bus campaign. The question is not, can we be good without belief in God? The question is, can we be good without God? The issue isn't belief in God, it's whether God exists. The issue that is being raised here is whether, in the absence of God, there is any objective difference between good and evil. It's raising the meta-ethical question about the basis for the moral values that we all hold dear and try to guide our lives by. If there is no God, then is the difference between good and evil, just like driving on the right-hand versus the left-hand side of the road, which varies with the culture and society you're in? Or is it just a matter of having a taste for certain foods or not? Some people like vanilla, other people like chocolate. And there isn't any objective truth about whether chocolate is better than vanilla. It's a matter of personal taste or opinion. Is that what moral values are like in the absence of God? Or are moral values somehow valid and binding on us regardless of what we think? And if they are objective in that way, then the question is, what is their foundation? Well, I think that the existence of objective moral values and duties provides a very good argument for the existence of God. Now, I myself stumbled into this argument through the back door, so to speak. I was speaking on university campuses on the absurdity of life without God. And what I would argue was purely negative. I would say that in the absence of God, that life ultimately becomes absurd. There is no ultimate meaning to life. There is no ultimate purpose in life. There are no ultimate objective values in life. Everything becomes relative and subjective. And I found, to my surprise, that the response of students to this argument was to say that objective moral values do exist, that we do experience that things are really right and wrong and good and evil. Now, what the students said didn't in any way undermine my claim that in the absence of God, there wouldn't be any objective moral values. By insisting that there are objective moral values, what the students had done is actually supplied the missing premise in an argument for God's existence. So we can argue in the following way, which is on the outline. If God does not exist, then objective moral values and duties do not exist. Two, objective moral values and duties do exist, from which it follows logically and inescapably, therefore, God exists. Now, this little argument is so easy to memorize. It is logically airtight. If the premises are true, the conclusion follows necessarily. That it's a wonderful argument, I think, to share with unbelievers. I had been arguing for the first premise, that if there is no God, then there are no objective moral values and duties. The students to whom I spoke supplied the second premise. There are objective moral values and duties, and it leads to the conclusion, therefore, God exists. And I think what makes this moral argument for God's existence so powerful is that people generally believe in both premises. They've just never put the two together to draw the logical conclusion. Students have been taught today that there are no objective moral values, that everything is relative to society and culture. And they've had this value of tolerance so deeply ingrained into them that they're deathly afraid of making a moral judgment about someone else. You've got to tolerate everything. So they've been taught premise one, that if there is no God, everything is relative. There are no objective moral values and duties. But the problem is that they also believe premise two, that there are objective moral values and duties. They're deeply committed, for example, to the value of tolerance. They think it's wrong to be bigoted and narrow-minded and dogmatic. So that their very commitment to tolerance is a commitment to the objective value of toleration. They think that it's objectively wrong to be intolerant of someone else. So they're committed to premise two as well as to premise one. And this can lead to some very strange conversations. I remember one student I was sharing the moral argument with, and when I would talk to him about premise one, he would agree with that and he would deny premise two. And then we'd go on to talk about premise two. And when we talked about that, he would agree with premise two and he'd deny premise one. And so we'd go back to premise one again and talk about that. And then he would agree to premise one and deny two. And so we would go back and forth jumping from one premise to the other with him unable to make up his mind. It would have been funny if it hadn't been so pathetic to see the student floundering desperately to try to avoid the obvious implication of objective moral values and duties, namely, that God exists. So I think that this is a very powerful argument for God's existence. And I want to look now more closely at each of the premises and see what sort of defense we can give of them and what kind of objections the unbeliever might raise. Now, the first premise says that if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. In order to understand this premise, it will be helpful to define a couple of terms, to make a couple of key distinctions. First, notice that I distinguish between values and duties. At least I hope I do on this outline. Sometimes I just talk about moral values. Does it have on the outline duties as well? No. Okay, well then let's talk about duties as well. The outline is an old one then. It should be, if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. Now, values have to do with whether something is good or bad. The value of something has to do with whether it's good or bad. Duties have to do with whether something is right or wrong. Duties have to do with whether something is right or wrong. Now, at first you might think that this is the distinction without a difference. This is the same thing. You might think, well, good and right mean the same thing, and bad and wrong mean the same thing. But I think if you'll reflect on this a little bit with me, you'll see that this really isn't the case at all. You see, duty has to do with moral obligation, with what you ought to do or what you ought not to do. There is a oughtness or shouldness involved with moral duty. But obviously, I'm not morally obligated to do something just because it would be good for me to do it. For example, it would be good for you to become a medical doctor. But that doesn't mean that you're obligated to become a medical doctor. Because after all, it would also be good for you to become a farmer or to become a homemaker or to become an architect. And obviously, you can't do them all. So just because something is good for you to do doesn't mean that you have a moral obligation or duty to do that thing. Moreover, sometimes we only have bad choices. We have to choose between the lesser of two evils. Think of the movie Sophie's Choice, where you remember a mother is put into this horrible situation by a Nazi concentration camp guard of choosing which of her children gets to live and which one is killed or exterminated. And to not choose, to refuse to choose, would mean they're both exterminated. And so this wretched mother has to choose to send one of her children off to be killed and to choose one of the children to go with her and hopefully live. She didn't have a good choice. She only had bad choices. And so sometimes we have to make choices where neither option is good, and nevertheless we choose. So I think when you reflect on it, there's clearly a difference between the good and the bad versus the right and the wrong. The good and the bad has to do with something's worth, its moral worth. Whether something is right or wrong has to do with something's being obligatory or forbidden. The one has to do with moral value, the other with moral duty. Now, is there any question about that distinction between moral values and moral duties at this point? Yes, way in the back. Well, certainly some values are conditional. For example, if you want to grow corn, it would be good for you to rotate your crops. But you're under no obligation to grow corn. That's not an unconditional duty. So, yes, there are certainly duties and obligations that are merely conditional. And that's the way I think a lot of unbelievers, in fact, think of moral duties. They think they're all just conditional. If you want to regard other people, say, as ends in themselves, then you ought to be a loving person or something. But the question is, why choose that? What is in that if clause, in that antecedent clause? What we're talking about here are unconditional obligations or unconditional goods or evils. Yes, I think that there clearly are. For example, I think it is unconditionally bad to torture a child for fun. That is, I think, clear. It's unconditionally good to be a loving and generous person. And I think that when most of us reflect on our moral experience, we do see that there is a clear, objective, unconditional difference between modes of behavior. But we'll get to that when we talk about the second premise. Yes, over here.
Bill, do they ever just object to the idea of moral values in itself? In this respect, I have some people occasionally who have said, well, look at animals. Mm-hmm. Animals behave instinctively good. And if they attack another animal and eat it, that's not evil, that's preservation. But
right.
But the point being that if it wasn't moral values, it was just instinctual, they could say, well, yeah, you don't torture a child because it's an animal instinct rather than
yes.
I think
that this attitude that you hear very, very prevalently in our culture today is supportive of premise one. This will be the sort of argument I'll give for premise one. If there is no God, then we're just animals. And the kind of behavior that we exhibit in human morality is simply echoed, or not echoed, it's foreshadowed already in the altruistic behavior that exists, say, in a troop of baboons, where natural selection has determined that if one scratches one's back, the other will scratch his back, and the species will survive more effectively if this sort of altruistic behavior is exhibited. So that is actually, I think, a powerful argument in support of premise one. Far from denying it, it supports it. Yes, Tom.
I know we've talked in the past about certain things existing out of necessity. Does anybody ever try to argue that moral values exist somehow out of necessity rather than...
Yes, we'll talk about this, Tom, when we get to premise two. I think what you'll find, and this is a surprise to most people, is that the wide majority of philosophers and university professors do believe that objective moral values exist. Although the ones that get the press are the ones who defend premise one, people like Richard Dawkins and others, the fact of the matter is, by far and away, most philosophers think that objective moral values and duties exist. And the question will be their grounding then, or their foundation. And some will say, well, you don't need a foundation. They're just there. They just exist necessarily. So we'll talk about that when we come to premise two. But what I want to focus on right now is there any question about this distinction between good, bad, and right, wrong, on the other hand? Cindy.
Maybe this is not where you want to go, but in my defense of this, with atheists, they would say God does not exist and moral values do exist.
So they would disagree with premise one.
Exactly. And I think that's where we get hung up. And I know you're going to go into this, but when you talk about naturalism and when you talk about, you know, how, if they do exist, how can they exist with no God?
Yeah.
And arguing that, I'm reminded of human civilizations that exercised what we would consider a bad value, like cannibalism, like
yes.
sacrificing virgins on a, you know, things that today would seem unthinkable.
Right.
Or even torturing children on a sacrificial bed, or Hitler, they go on and on and on, you know, that only by exercising a sense of goodness or doing what's right have we been able to succeed as a society, that we've sort of learned these behaviors when we used to be tribal and, you know, it was survival of the fittest in the purest sense, you know, they would conquer other tribes and
right.
cannibalize and torture, and it's just really hard for me to get agreement on number one.
Well, I think it's hard, if that's the answer to the giving, it's hard for you to get clarity on their response, because what I heard there was talking out of both sides of the mouth. On the one hand, you don't need God to have objective moral values and duties. On the other hand, then, what I hear is, but look at the relativity of moral values among societies and cultures in the world, about how they used to do things in ancient world realm that now we would find morally unthinkable, and that we've simply learned how to live together in society. That's supporting premise one. So you've got two different contradictory things coming out of the same person's mouth. On the one hand, he wants to affirm the objectivity of moral values and duties, but then when he explains it, it's supportive of premise one. It says moral values and duties are just things that we've learned over the centuries, and they still vary widely from culture to culture, society to society. So what we want to know is, with what right can one culture or society say that the moral values of another are objectively wrong, rather than just different? Right, that's right. They're relative. And so why can one culture or society think that its values are right and another's are mistaken, if there is no God to act as a transcendent anchor point from which these different cultural viewpoints can be judged? Absent that transcendent viewpoint, aren't you just left with a plurality of cultures and societies which have evolved different mores, and what is unthinkable in one is thinkable in another, and who's to say whose cultural values are right and whose are wrong? That's supportive of premise one. All right, now, that's the first distinction. I want to hit the other distinction before we finish today, because that's important as well. The other distinction, then, is the distinction between objective and subjective. Objective and subjective. By objective, I mean independent of people's opinions. Something is objective if it's independent of people's opinions. By subjective, I mean dependent upon people's opinions. Subjective means dependent upon people's opinions. So, when we say that there are objective moral values and duties, what we are asserting is that certain things are good or bad, right or wrong, independently of what anybody thinks about it. It doesn't matter if everybody in the world disagreed and believed something else. These moral values would still be true and real. That's what it means to say that something is objective. To say that we have objective moral values means that something is good or bad regardless of what people think about it. Similarly, to say we have objective moral duties to fulfill means that we have moral obligations and prohibitions which are binding on us regardless of what we think. And so the claim is, in premise one, that if there is no God, then moral values and duties are not objective in that sense. It's to say that there are no moral objective moral values and duties in that sense. Now, is there any question about that distinction between objective and subjective? An easy way to remember it is subjective sounds like a subject. And so it's dependent upon what somebody thinks, what the subject thinks. Objective sounds like object, and that's just out there. That's an object regardless of what you think. So objective is the thing that is real, independent of anybody's opinion. Subjective is what depends upon some subject's view of it. All right. Any other question then about, let me illustrate what it would be to say that something is objectively wrong. Take the Holocaust. For example, to say that the Holocaust was objectively wrong is to say that the Holocaust was wrong even though the Nazis who carried it out thought that it was right. And it would still have been wrong even if the Nazis had won World War II and succeeded in brainwashing or exterminating everybody who disagreed with them so that everybody in the world thought the Holocaust was right and good. To say that the Holocaust is objectively wrong means that it's wrong regardless of the outcome of World War II. And the premise is that if there is no God, then moral values and duties are not objective in that sense. Any comment or question about that? Yes, back in the back.
So to go back to your original opening statement about be good for goodness sake, goodness would be a subjective value.
No, goodness would be something that would exist in the sense that, say, being a loving person is a good thing. A person who is a loving person has the quality of goodness insofar as he is loving and selfless.
But if my love is squashing my child's ability to be independent, then it's
Well, I would say that's objectively bad because you're hurting another person who is a bearer of intrinsic moral value. You're crippling that other individual by your actions, so that would be objectively wrong to do that. So to say you do something for goodness sake is to say you do it because it is the right thing to do. Now, I distinguish, remember, between goodness and rightness. So you're not morally obligated to do something just because it's good. Remember, we illustrated that. But suppose that this is the right thing for you to do, then you should do it because it's right, not because you're going to get a reward or it's going to redound to your self-interest or something of that sort. And it really is right for you to do it, even if you don't think that it's right. That's what we mean when we say it's objective. Yes?
To the first statement, if God does not exist, moral values and duties don't exist. Not only don't they exist, but the terms good and evil are meaningless. That even goes...
Well, it would mean
to the
that
core of that.
I wouldn't say they're meaningless, though I think I understand what you're saying. It would be to say that they have no referent, that they don't refer to anything, or they have to be redefined so that they refer to what some others in the class have already mentioned, that which is conducive to human flourishing, or that which will promote harmonious living in society. You redefine the terms to mean something else. But I think you're quite right in saying that in the absence of God, there just is no good and evil. These words refer to nothing, right? You can be mistaken about what you think the good or the right is. Certainly, this is not an argument to say that our moral perceptions are infallible. We make mistakes all the time. But the very fact of moral error points to the objectivity of these values. If they're not objective, you can't err, right? You can't fail to do the right thing or the good thing because it's all subjective anyway. So the very fact of moral error and moral disagreement and moral failure actually presupposes the objectivity of moral values and moral duties. Any other comment? All right, well, that brings us to a good breaking place. And so what we'll do next time is consider what arguments might be given in defense of the first premise that in the absence of God, moral values and duties are not objective. So until then, I wish you a good week.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.